Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:16 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is August 23rd, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off with the Dow Gold Index, or ratio. And I've put a 5-year moving average on it. So we can see, for example, during the bull market, between approximately 1945 and then the ultimate peak in approximately 1965, the moving average represented an area of resistance, the 5-year moving average. Then when we look at the move that we had in the 1980s through to the peak in 1999, the moving average was less useful. It was useful at the beginning of the trend, not the end. And it's been useful so far in this bull market. There have been occasions when gold has outperformed. We're definitely in one of those right now. Gold has, the ratio has contracted from 22.5 to under 17. So that is a very meaningful move in terms of the ratio between gold and the Dow Jones. Now the question is whether the moving average is going to represent support. Because the most bullish forecasts for gold are for the price to get into the 5-figure numbers. And obviously that would require either a massive move in gold and a decline in the Dow Jones to reach a ratio that would bring it all the way back to the lows we've seen at nadirs in the early 1930s and the early 1980s. The low that we saw in the early, or I guess in 2011, was around 7. So it did not get down to almost parity levels that we saw at the peaks of previous gold bull markets. But the much broader picture is that when we look at this longer term ratio, each of the highs is higher than the last. There have been occasions where we have had counter trend rallies in a downtrend, but this does not qualify as one of them. There was a temptation to think that we might have a repeat of this kind of situation from we had a significant counter trend rally in the gold in the Dow Gold ratio in 1974 through to about 1976, and subsequently the ratio went to a new low. There was a temptation to think that that's what we were getting in 2011 through to 2013. It's been going on for too long for that to be a realistic potential. So therefore the question is, rather, are we instead at a situation similar to what we had, for example, in the 1930s. There was a meaningful rally in the ratio, and then it went sideways for the next decade before then starting to go higher. That is a question that is probably being asked a lot today because of the moves that we've had in the bond markets. What I found particularly interesting was the ratio that Gavcal produced in one of their reports, and I will post it in comment of the day today. And it gives us the ratio of the total return on bonds to gold. So we had a really very meaningful move in terms of the outperformance of gold relative to bonds between approximately the early 2000s and 2011, and the moving average is just starting to roll over. The ratio has already pushed on to a new reaction low, so gold is now outperforming bonds on a total return basis. That's against the background where we've had an incredibly strong move in terms of the total return on bonds. That's, I think, something that does bear some scrutiny. We've had a very big move in terms of the total return on bonds. It has bounced and pulled away from the moving average. There's quite a wide overextension relative to the trend mean right now. Investors are increasingly predicting that US 10-year treasuries are going to have negative yields. Well, we've already had a very meaningful move when we look at the 10-year treasury yield. It's already had a significant contraction over this year, and we're right in the region of the 1.5% level. There have been occasions where it has dipped below this over the course of the last decade, but those occasions have not been sustained. I think one of the big points, and it's a topic that doesn't seem to be getting a lot of discussion recently, because the dollar has been so very calm, then people are not really pricing in the potential that we're going to have more volatility. But that's the wrong way to think about a market. When the dollar has been doing nothing at all for more than a year and a half already, then we are closer to the point when it is going to become a very significant factor. The dollar index was down in a dynamic manner in here today. Now, when we look at it over the last year, it's been incredibly choppy, and it has repeatedly found support in the region of the trend mean. So it does look likely that it is going to go down and test that level again. One of the reasons why the USA has been able to come through the trade war relatively unscathed so far, in terms of the economy broadly, and particularly the consumer, is because inflation has been kept in check. The devaluation of the renminbi, which took an additional leg lower in here this week, is a clear counter measure implemented by the Chinese to try and soften the blow to their own economy from declining exports. I think we do need to also look at it on a longer term basis to put into focus just where it or how weak it has traded in the past. The significant devaluation that we saw in 1994 took it from five and change to almost nine in the space of a couple of weeks. Since then, the currency had been really quite steady and appreciated from the early 2000s, but it was that all-in-one-go devaluation that put the Chinese economy in a very competitive position before it entered the World Trade Organization in the early 2000s. They have demonstrated repeatedly they're willing to use the renminbi as a policy tool, and it's likely that we're going to see additional measures to devalue the currency. One thing that stood out in here today is that Bitcoin has been steady around the 10,000 level, but one of the primary reasons why people are interested in Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies generally is because they are outside of the control of any government, and Bitcoin is essentially a Chinese cryptocurrency. The vast majority of the mining for Bitcoin happens in China. A lot of the transactions also happen in China, and it has been one of the primary conduits through which Chinese investors have been getting their money out of China. There is obviously a clear risk of capital flight from China if they continue to devalue their currency. When I was there for last week and part of the week before, I also was in Taiwan. Something that was quite clear is that consumption habits are definitely changing. There's also a lot more Chinese cars on the road. BYD, for example, has changed the nameplate on the front of the car. It used to say in Roman, or I guess in Western letters, BYD. Now it's written in Chinese. So that's subtle, but it is also a clear demonstration that they are supporting the domestic manufacturers. We've also seen plenty of examples where the demand in restaurants has been lower. That if you go at prime time in around 8 o'clock, than in the most popular restaurants, particularly those that are Michelin starred, then you may have to queue for a while. But if you go there around 6 o'clock, there wasn't any wait at all, even among some of the best crab restaurants, and this is the season for crabs in China. Then we didn't really have to wait at all if we were willing to eat at around 6:30. That's something that we've never really encountered. Any other time we've ever been to China in the last decade, the most popular restaurants, regardless of what time you turn up after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, have required some form of a wait. Well, that clearly says to me that we are getting evidence that demand is slowing down, that demand for vehicles is also slowing down. Then when we think about what's happening in terms of the commodity index, it would be tempting to think that it's simply because China is putting tariffs on US exports of oil or soybeans or lean hogs that the price of commodities is trending downwards. But there is the additional point that copper inventories are rather high right now. They're the highest they've been in at least the last few years on the LME. And this is a consistent downtrend. The continuous commodity index is unweighted, so it isn't particularly influenced by what's happening in the gold market. When we then look at what's happening in terms of the oil market, then the fact that China is willing to put tariffs on US oil, that they're putting tariffs on oil, on pigs, on soybeans, these are some of the commodities that they vitally need. There has been clear evidence of food price inflation in China, and that's an additional point that not only do they have a weakening currency, they have an inflation problem, and they have slowing domestic demand. China badly needs a raft of additional stimulative measures. We are starting to see that coming through. The downtrend that we're seeing in the oil price is representative of ample supply, but also of the threat of falling demand. And that is one of the threats. When we think about what's going on in terms of the US economy, the big question we need to ask is how long is US exceptionalism going to last? When, for example, we look at the European stock market, then it had bounced earlier this week from the region of the trend mean. It gave up a good part of that advance in here today, with the Euro stocks down about 1%. But considering the fact that the vast majority of the indices on the US finished down in excess of 2%, then that is likely to feed through into activity for the European markets on Monday. Of course, the UK is going to be shut on Monday, but the rest of Europe will be open. And it is likely that the pullback on Wall Street is going to have an effect on the Nikkei, most particularly because the Nikkei is largely dependent on the outlook for the yen. And the yen strengthened really quite considerably in here today. That was a very clear upward dynamic. And it rather suggests that there is going to be additional upward pressure on the currency. This is going to require a meaningful response from the Bank of Japan. Well, when we start to thread the responses that are required from central banks, China needs stimulus. They have been inching towards it. They've certainly been running a massive fiscal deficit, but they do need the kind of monetary kick that they have been willing to provide previously just to support their own economy. Quite whether there's going to be the kind of cohesion in terms of the willingness of central bank officials to coordinate with one another against the background of the trade war is open to question. But the fact remains that just on a self-interested basis, central banks need to be doing more. That's basically what we heard from the Federal Reserve in here today, the USA doesn't feel like they have a great deal of urgency because retail sales have continued to do really rather well. For example, Target surged higher in here this week on strong earnings. It was the same for Lowe's, and considering that they are selling goods primarily aimed at home improvement, that also highlights the fact that interest rates are really quite low, and that should be generally positive for the home sector and home buying and building. The fall in oil prices is probably a mixed blessing for the USA, since it's now one of the most significant exporters, but it's positive for the consumer. And when we think about the gasoline price, well, it's just below $4 a gallon in California right now, but it does look like it is going to start trending downwards. So that will put more money in consumers' pockets. So when we then go back and think about what exactly is going on in terms of the stock market, well, one thing that I'm reminded of is this adage that it's a market of shares, and you don't buy countries, you buy companies. That's usually used as a bullish phenomenon, that you don't have to worry so much about the country because you can buy the company. But perhaps we need to think about it a little bit differently at present, because when we think about US consumers, then the consumer is still doing pretty good. And the jobless rate is still reasonably well contained. So when we then think about what is likely to happen in terms of a recession, well, you can't really have a recession without people losing their jobs. And I think that's a really quite important consideration. Everyone seems to be really worried about the fact that we have got the potential for a recession because of the yield curve. But other factors also need to fall into place. The fact that we have such very low interest rates, and that we have recessionary forces already active in Europe, and negative real, not only real yields, we've got negative yields all over the world, then what are most particularly in Europe and Japan, that's creating this momentum move in the bond markets. And that momentum move in the bond markets is could be read as deflationary in nature. It's probably more deflationary for Europe and for China and Japan and South Korea because of their export focus than it is particularly for the USA. That doesn't necessarily mean that the difficulties these countries are having isn't going to feed back into the USA. But it does bring us to the question about the reliance of US multinationals on global growth. And that's potentially what we're seeing in terms of the volatility that's increasing on the stock market. Wage growth is around 3.2% right now in the USA, and that's not far off the highest levels we've seen since 2009. It's certainly above 3%, and that's really quite favorable. With commodity prices coming down, and with the jobless rate still looking quite good, then the big question for the bond yield is going to be about inflation. And the one thing that could start to spark inflation would be a weaker dollar. Well, when we then think about the Eurozone, Europe badly needs a weaker currency, and they are quite likely to do whatever is necessary in order to achieve a weaker currency. And we're likely to find out what that is in September, but it could quite likely include a tiering of interest rates, negative interest rates, and additional quantitative easing. And against that background, then we could anticipate that the euro should be weaker. But the Federal Reserve is also lowering interest rates, and they've just announced a $1.2 trillion dollar fiscal stimulus by raising the debt limits. That suggests that we are going to have competitive currency devaluation, and that is the degree to which the dollar is steady or not is likely to have a significant arbitrary effect on what is the outlook for inflation, and particularly for the bond markets, because the bond market is pricing in deflation. Nobody is worried about inflation. Nobody seems to be worried about currency market volatility. But the one thing we know from a ranging environment is that ranges are explosions waiting to happen. And the direction in which the dollar eventually breaks is going to have a material impact on inflationary expectations. And when we then think about the Dow gold ratio, and we look at the total return on bonds to gold ratio, well, there's a good reason why people are looking at gold as a hedge. Because gold has broken out of a 6-year base formation. And this is a really quite significant major move. It reasserts medium-term demand dominance, and this is a very significant event. But that's because we're only looking at it in US dollars. When we start to look at it in other currencies, then it had been broadly ranging in Australian dollars for 7 years and then broke out, and this is a very meaningful advance. In Brazilian real, it's also breaking out, this time from a 3-year range and extending its advance. One of the things that we've said repeatedly over the years is that gold does best when it is appreciating in all currencies. And today, it's appreciating in all currencies. There is no currency against which gold is not pushing on to new high ground. Even the yen, which had been among the strongest rallies against the dollar in here today, has gold at a new all-time high. When we then look at the big buying countries like China, well, it's not so long ago that gold was at 9,000 renminbi, and it's closing in on 11,000 now. And then when we think about India, it's at a new all-time high. And this is a very meaningful advance. When we think about the Korean won, we've seen gold surging higher over the course of just the last few months. What this is clearly telling us is that investors are just not hanging around. What they are in fact doing is hedging their exposure to competitive currency devaluation. What we have also got ample evidence of is that gold is doing best against commodity-related currencies. And part of the reason for that is because those currencies had been so weak after the commodity boom bust in 2011. And by contrast, gold held up substantially better. This does represent a bull market opportunity in gold because of this competitive currency devaluation. When we then go back and think about gold's performance relative to equities or relative to bonds, then it's competitive about whether gold is going to be the best hedge against competitive currency devaluation relative to equities or bonds. Bonds are quite likely to be a bad hedge against currency devaluation, because the supply of bonds is likely to increase measurably over the course of the next few years. Governments the world over are broke, and they have got significant challenges ahead of them in trying to support their respective economies. Now the question is that, and then of course we have the fiscal situation. The USA led the world in terms of extraordinary monetary policy, but they also took the very painful measure of the foreclosure crisis and recapitalizing the banks. So the S&P 500 banks index is weak right now, but it's not nearly as risky as the European banking sector. The quantity of bad loans that are outstanding in the US banking sector is a fraction of what we see in Europe. That doesn't necessarily mean that the banks index is going to continue to trend higher. The prospect of significantly lower interest rates and the yield curve inverting, that particularly has an effect on the ability of banks to extend credit. But perhaps one of the more important points is that banks haven't been the primary source of credit in this bull market. Central banks have been, and then so has private equity. Private equity have been able to source capital through the banks directly from the discount window. They've been able to raise vast sums from pension funds and insurance companies because of the outsized yields that they've been able to provide. And it is in the private equity sector where the clearest risks lie. I have a strong intuition that the WeWork IPO is perhaps going to be one of the greatest ironies in history, because it may coincide with lots of people losing their jobs. The reality that the CEO cashed out with an $800 million sale from his holdings only a couple of months before the IPO is a massive red flag. The way that the company has been structured is that it is effectively lying to its landlords, and that's a major issue. And the only possible way the company can persist is in continued expansion, and the only way it can fund that is with negative interest rates. And that's a massively leveraged business model, particularly against a background where rents in some of the world's most desirable cities are at record highs. And nobody is pricing in inflation. Now, that is something that is an argument that is persona non grata right now, because nobody cares about inflation when bond prices are rallying the way they have been. But if we do get a move in the dollar and people start to pay attention to the competitive devaluation that's going on in terms of currencies, then there is the potential that inflationary pressures are going to rise, and that is something that could have a very negative effect on bond prices. Now, when we think about the outlook for the equity markets, well, the S&P 500 has pulled back to the region of the trend mean. And that does not look right. I don't know. Oops, I can see why. We're still in South African rand. When we think about the outlook for the S&P, we've had a couple of failed upside breaks, and now we've had another. Now the question is whether the region of the trend mean is going to hold. We had a move to a new high in September of last year, and it failed, and it went on to a new low. We had a failed break down here, and it went straight back up to the top. It failed there and came back to the region of the trend mean, and we had a very impressive upward dynamic and upside key reversal from the region of the trend mean, which took it all the way back up to a new all-time high. Well, the breakout above 2900 has not held. And now it's coming back to test the region of the trend mean, and it was down heavily in here today because of fears about the trade war and the potential for it to get worse. I rather think that the trade war is going to get worse, that we are in more of a Cold War situation than a trade war, that there is a clear difference between the willingness of the USA to run, historically at least, a trade deficit with Germany, and they never really expressed any problem with Germany's exports increasing and in fact competing with those of the USA historically, or indeed for Japan, because both Germany and Japan were allies. Well, what China has clearly stated was that any hope that China would become an ally is dead. They view the USA as a strategic competitor. And they have been very clear in stating exactly that. They're not leaving any room for equivocation. And that's a significant issue because there has been vast sums invested in China. There has been huge amounts of money flowing into China to support its economy and to grow the economy and to take advantage of the relative value play in terms of labor and regulation. And over the course of the last few decades, prices have gone up in China, wages have risen in China, property prices have exploded in China. The USA is now a major energy exporter as opposed to being a major importer. So the relative value play of manufacturing in China is not as strong today as it was previously. The big differentiators now are in terms of regulation and the existing infrastructure. One of the points that purchasing managers make about where to source their materials, whether they should build factories domestically and build themselves, or whether they should go off and do it elsewhere, is the availability of middle management and of production engineers. The USA doesn't really have a lot of production engineers. Germany does. A number of European countries do. South Korea does, and China does. It's not easy to build a new factory in China, and the middle management that have got a clear focus on manufacturing is not nearly as existent. That doesn't mean that the USA can't have that. It's just simply that it doesn't have it today. The big question, therefore, is what the risk is for the corporate sector. The corporate sector obviously has risk. They have the risk of the trade war intensifying and increasingly large tariffs being put on anything that comes out of China. Well, that puts that gives a great incentive to US companies to source their goods from somewhere else. And the big beneficiaries potentially are India and Vietnam, and potentially also Ethiopia for really lower cost goods. The Nifty index has been trending higher over the course of the last few years. There is, however, a rather significant liquidity crisis in portions of the housing finance sector and in portions of the banking sector as a result. And the rupee has been weakening. So India is cutting interest rates, and they are rather eager to try and support their economy. there is probably going to have to be some form of assistance provided to the banking sector and the housing finance sector to get past this non-performing loans issue. But India is a clear potential beneficiary of the migration of manufacturing away from China as a result of the trade war and increasingly the Cold War. Because once the manufacturing dependency has been eradicated, then the potential for a Cold War situation to intensify will have increased substantially. And this is the big challenge for the global order, that not only do we have the trade war and increasing competition between nations, but then we also have the fact that we have had a populist revolt, and that populist revolt is driving the increasing nationalism. The one question that people have when they haven't seen their living standards rise for years, and when they have seen interest rates collapse, asset prices inflate enormously, but no benefits to themselves, they start asking, "What about me?" And governments are increasingly answering that with, "Here, have some money." And that "here, have some money" is being manifested in the provision of liquidity from central banks and massive fiscal stimulus from governments. In here this week, we had 200 of the largest corporations in the world say that profit motivation is no longer their primary objective. Well, quite whether that is PR or not, it does highlight the fact that they see a very clear risk from the rise of populism and antitrust, that they are clearly at, I think, signaling that they understand where the risks lie. That rather than thinking about the trade war, where the greatest risks for the corporate sector reside are in clearly more regulation and the union movement. The union movement in future might be more government driven, and then corporations are going to have to respond. They are going to have to come up with an environmental charter for the simple reason that it's being demanded by certain portions of the political establishment because they believe that's what the people want. But they're also going to have to start paying higher wages, and more than any other factor, that represents a challenge for stock markets. That's something that is potentially could create a significant hiatus in terms of a secular bull market, where corporations do have to deal with these demands coming through from the general population. And that's one of the side effects of this massive move we've had in bond yields. Clear rationale is that low bond yields rob savers. And it's not just the pension funds and insurance companies that we're talking about, but it also is very much the case for the regular saver. I remember as a child, I used to be given saving certs as for birthdays or for when I was born, I was given some saving certs. And I cashed them out when I was 16, and because Ireland's interest rates in the early in the late 1970s and the early 1980s were in the double digits and they had compounded over time, then I was making two and three and four times my money on those savings certs when I redeemed them. That kind of return on an investment is and at a risk-free investment is completely impossible for regular savers in here today. The only possible way that they can achieve that kind of return is to take on additional risk, and that is something that is clearly at odds with a rising living standard, because when you take on additional risk, then you have to take on the potential for catastrophic loss. And That is exactly what happened in the credit crisis, and that is one of the things that people have been very slow to recover from. And that's one of the primary reasons why we have had this rise of populism. It's not purely about xenophobia or racism or nationalism. It's not really about the question about the environment or whether one is for a Green Deal or not, or for universal basic income, but it's all symptomatic of a broader problem, which is the clear failure of globalization to deliver higher standards of living for the people who suffered most from its implementation. The fact that manufacturing is contracting everywhere is representative of a slowdown, but most particularly a slowdown in China and in Europe, because that's where the manufacturing out of the world is focused. It's not as much of a problem for the USA or, for example, the UK, because they've been denuded of manufacturing over the course of the last 20 years. The so-called manufacturing renaissance has added on approximately 1.5 million jobs to 2 million jobs in the USA over the course of the last decade. Historically, that is one of the smallest additions of new jobs that has been or has been achieved in any expansion. In a recession, the US economy generally loses in the order of anything from 2 to 4 million manufacturing jobs, which suggests that in the next recession, whenever that is, manufacturing in both the UK and potentially in the USA could be all but eradicated. At the moment, that's obviously a significant risk, and it also is something that could exacerbate the widening gap between the haves and the have-nots, because manufacturing was one of the best jobs to have because it pays more. Manufacturing tends to be more volatile, so you do tend to get you have the risk of losing your job during a decline, but getting it back when the economy starts to expand once more. This is no longer available to millions of workers. Then the decline in coal is an additional problem because mining is one of the best paid jobs anywhere. And when mining jobs die, then it takes whole communities with it because there is nothing that can come in to replace those kinds of jobs, short of highly technical jobs that require years of training or education. And swinging a shovel and swinging a pick is not really something that requires a great deal of education. When we then start to think about where are we in terms of the cycle, well, we know that we've got some late cycle activity right now. The fact that the yield curve is inverted and that the banking sector is touch and go in the USA is significant. But I think it is worth highlighting that the banking sector in Europe is pressuring its lows, and it looks completely different to what we've had in the USA. If and even if we think about the trend that the clear potential that the outlook for the US banking sector is going to get worse as a result of the outlook for interest rates, and that regional banks are going to extend their breakdown from new lows, or, for example, that the transportation index is going to extend its decline next week. These are all late cycle factors. They all point towards the potential for an economic slowdown. The question is whether we are going to get a recession, and whether central banks are going to act quickly enough to cut interest rates aggressively. They do have the incentive to do so because of the trade war. This represents the breakdown in terms of the globalization effort that has been going on now for approximately 40 years. And we are in a multipolar world now, and that is likely to become increasingly pressured. The fact that the USA is a major energy exporter is something that could hold its alliances together, but it also needs to be willing to continue to run deficits. It needs to be willing to accept imports from its partner nations. The problem is that its partner nations, which have historically been Europe and Japan, also depend on China for their exports. And there is a great game type competition between the USA and China for the export markets, for the big geopolitical players of the world to support them in terms of their military support. But the price that the USA has paid to achieve that military support historically has been to buy their goods. And that has been one of the foundations of NATO. With the increasing tension that Donald Trump is introducing into the multilateral agreements, then that does begin to raise questions about the sustainability of the entire project. When we then think about what's happening in terms of the Russell Index, then that's generally considered to be, well, it is small caps, and small caps are more interest rate sensitive. And it is also, well, I think when we think about the trend generally, we had a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and now we have this period of right-hand extension. It looks quite different to the trends we have for the Dow, the S&P, and for the Nasdaq. Small caps do tend to lead. So if the Russell breaks down, then that is going to represent a challenge for the wider market. I do think that it is relevant to point out that when we look at the S&P 500, that it has tended to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, and that would be, let me just make sure that I can do the math and talk at the same time. This is a monthly chart. 1,000 days is 5 years, so that should be 60 months. That's about right. When we then think about the outlook for the wider market, I'm pretty sure that I have not done the math correctly here, but I know that the 1,000-day moving average has found support in the region of these significant medium-term lows put in over the course of the last few years. And the 1,000-day moving average does tend to be an area of support during the big secular bull markets. The big question is, I think, and we're going to find out an answer to this at the end of September, is about corporate profits. And I do think this will be one of the most important signals to pay attention to. It has tended to hit major peaks well in advance of bigger declines generally. That was most especially the case in 2006. Now, we had a significant peak in 2014, and because of quantitative easing, because of the accommodation that we've seen over the course of the last 5 years, corporate profits have been really very steady. But they were revised downwards from the figures that we saw posted last, or posted for the first quarter. This index is posted on a quarterly basis, but a quarter in arrears. So the figure that we get at the end of September will be for the second quarter. If it drops downwards and we start to see a decline, then that is likely to represent a real challenge for the stock market because it will start to change the PE ratio calculations. That if earnings are starting to deteriorate, then the ratio would start to rise, and it would make the argument that the market is really quite expensive much more compelling. We are at the end of August, and there are a significant number of assistance measures that are being provided by central banks the world over. So it does take time for those to have an effect, but the big question is really about corporate profitability. So we're going to have an answer for this particular question at the end of September. Ideally, the S&P 500 will find support in the region of the trend mean. But then when we think about the kinds of shares that have been doing really very well, then they are due some consolidation. They have got really quite wide overextensions relative to the trend mean, so there is, I think, ample scope here for a reversionary process to unfold. That's even the case for some of the those that are most viewed as bond proxies. Bond prices really do look very overextended right now. So, even with the big move that we had in here today, I do think that there is room for consolidation. The reality is that this week we saw the German 30-year Bund, bond that was proposed with a zero coupon. It failed at auction. They only sold 846 million of the 2.2 billion that they had hoped for. But the market continued to rally following that event, and Bunds in here today were steadier. So we're in silly season in terms of the bond markets. This has been an incredible move, and there's not a great deal of evidence to suggest that it is over yet. The one big potential item that could derail the entire advance in bonds would be an uptick in inflationary pressures, but with global economies starting to slow and a very real risk of recession in Europe, then that might be less of an issue in Europe than it is in the USA. The long term does look like we are in a commodity bear market that's particularly represented by oil prices, but gold does stand apart, and its massive outperformance over the course of the last 3 months suggests that we are in a new medium-term bull market. The fact that it is a monetary metal and it is appreciating versus every currency is really very important. The additional point, I think, in here today, that we are starting to see some of the highly risky portions of the bond markets and the high yield markets coming under pressure. That's a response to the slowing economy. It's also a response to the fact that we are getting more pressure coming to bear on these highly risky entities, whether that is WeWork or Netflix or even Tesla or General Electric or Kraft Heinz, where there is a risk it could be downgraded in 2021 or 2020. The potential for the high yield sector to become larger as a result of downgrades, the fact that the spreads on high yield energy bonds are continuing to rise and will potentially go up further if we see the oil price coming down even further, and that does look likely. So there are portions of the bond market are looking particularly risky, whether that is in treasuries or in high yield. That is where risk is concentrated. By extension, the private equity sector is extraordinarily leveraged to a significant number of companies that have got little prospect of becoming ever profitable. When we think about the fact that Uber is a company just like that, where the chances of the company ever making a profit are so far out in the horizon that we might be talking about never. Then there is the fact that there is so much additional liquidity hitting the market that it does have the potential to inflate asset prices. The fact that gold is outperforming right now suggests that it is the asset that is going to do best in that kind of environment. But stocks also do tend to do well in that kind of environment. So this is a potential source of demand for the equity markets, and the willingness of investors to support the S&P in the region of the trend mean, and most particularly companies like Amazon, where earnings are positive, where the retailers are doing well, then its ability to hold the trend mean next week is going to be an important question. And this is obviously something that does need to be monitored. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.